Thank you, Dennis. Finally, Daniel.
Well, I'm glad Dennis Bark beat me to the punch because I too plan to say some words about the transatlantic misunderstanding, some of the sources of the growing differences between the United States and Europe over the last generation. In my remarks today, I'm going to draw upon and perhaps summarize themes I've developed in three or four articles over the last couple of years that discuss the development of what I see as the dominant ethos in Western Europe today, an ethos that some have called humanitarian democracy. I don't want to suggest that this is the only current of thought or the only, you might say, European affect. And in fact, in my remarks, I'm going to draw on European critics of European humanitarianism. But let me just start by saying this. In recent months, I've seen more and more commentators using the occasion of the United States' difficulties or setbacks in Iraq to suggest that this is evidence of a kind of vindication of the European position regarding foreign affairs. So the argument is the Europeans said going into Iraq was a bad idea. We've seen grave difficulties in the conduct of the war, and we've come up against a certain intractability in the Arab-Islamic world. Therefore, the Europeans were wiser, drawing upon a sort of deeper historical understanding, a deeper understanding of statecraft. The problem, I suggest, and this is, I think, a good entrance into my theme of humanitarian democracy, is that many, and perhaps most, European critics of our intervention in Iraq did not justify that opposition on prudential grounds. They instead made arguments. You all remember Dominique de Villepin, the former foreign minister of France, Jacques Chirac telling us, war is always the worst solution. In other words, I think Americans paid less attention to sometimes prudent advice from Europeans when that advice was posed as sort of a categorical recommendation of non-intervention or of the primacy of international organization and law over the exercise of national sovereignty, etc. So I think we make a mistake conflating prudential arguments made by Europeans about the war from this kind of categorical humanitarian condemnation of the use of force to core. All right. I want to say a word about, and again, I'm painting in very broad brushes, but I'd like to suggest that the roots of this new and I've suggested dominant European ethos can be found, broadly speaking, in that magical year 1968. We're up against the 40th anniversary of the May events in France. We sometimes forget that while America witnessed unprecedented unrest in the streets and on college campuses in 1968, that same year saw a truly global challenge to liberal civilization in the form of the so-called New Left. And the only place this had something to do with the particular facts on the ground, it also had something to do with a revolutionary tradition. The only place where that unrest and that critique risked culminating in political revolution was in France, when the seemingly the Gaullist regime came very close to collapse by the end of May 1968. Although de Gaulle, as we all know, was able to rally a French silent majority and restore order. Nonetheless, many commentators, including French commentators, have spoken about 1968's ultimate cultural success. That event may have been, the May events may have been a political failure in their effort to bring about revolutionary transformation, but they provided the crucial impetus for the colonization of social and cultural institutions recommended as far back as the 1920s by the Italian Marxist theorist Antonio Gramsci. Luc Ferry and Alain Renaud, in their book La Pensée de 68, The Thought of 68, have argued that if a series of radical anti-humanist postmodernist theorists were not perhaps responsible for the unrest in France in 68, their thought was certainly wrapped up in it, both inspiring it, quoted by the principal actors, and was given a kind of impetus by those events. Roger Scruton has spoken, I think, very suggestively about a culture of repudiation which became influential throughout the Western world in the wake of 1968, a culture of repudiation that challenged the very idea of truth and of authoritative norms and social institutions. Since it's the anniversary we're approaching the anniversary of the May events, it's helpful to remember the sort of dominant slogan on the streets of Paris in that month, in that year: it is forbidden to forbid. It is forbidden to forbid, which is a truly infantile, antinomian sentiment, but it's also one that I think was a portent of things to come. In any case, the most eloquent and vocal and eloquent French critic of the events of May 68 was the great French political thinker, I'll anglicize, Raymond Aron. And Aron was also, as far as I know, the first serious European critic of humanitarian democracy, or what he called the depoliticization of Europe. In a series of writings in the 70s and 80s, Aron expressed deep forebodings about the future of liberal Europe. He thought, he wrote, for example, in his book, In Defense of Decadent Europe, that Europe was in the process of losing sight of the political virtues necessary to sustain liberal civilizations. Liberals had forgotten that a free society depended upon authoritative institutions, such as the university, army, and church. Aron was very struck by the fact that the Dutch had introduced unions into the armed forces, which he thought was fundamentally antithetical to the very idea of a political order. Aron spoke, who was not prone toward apocalyptic utterances, spoke of the early 70s, mid-70s, of a crisis of civilization and the decadence of free and prosperous peoples who are increasingly bereft of civic spirit and martial virtue. All right, so, and Aron was no conservative traditionalist, but he argued that if the West was to renew itself, it must continue to draw on broader and deeper cultural and spiritual resources than those that were provided by what we might call modern individualism. Europe in particular must aspire to something more ennobling than the endless expansion of rights and the claims of aggrieved individuals and minorities. And in particular, it was necessary for the West in general and Europe in particular to renew a capacity for concertive collective action by drawing judiciously upon the moral inheritance of the pre-modern Western tradition, the still living attachments of many Europeans to the nation states of the continent, and the commitment to political liberty that provides the indispensable framework for individual freedom, individual independence. The problem, of course, is since Aron expressed those thoughts in the 1970s, I think it's fair to say that Europeans have drifted precisely in a more humanitarian, less politically minded direction. They're less prone to think of themselves as national peoples belonging to a common civilization called the West. Little remains of a sense of reverence toward the European past. And Europeans, I think, again, I'm painting with a broad brush, no longer identify or connect democracy with a millennial old inheritance. Instead, their patriotic loyalties are to a procedural view of democracy that in principle recognizes no territorial boundaries or binding political attachments. Think of the Federal Republic of Germany, the transformation from the sort of founding justifications of constitutional democracy, the thinkers and actors associated with Adenauer and the Christian Democrats, to the role that Jürgen Habermas plays, the great theoretician of constitutional patriotism, a kind of procedural view of democracy. It's, if you ever, well, good luck reading Habermas, but you'll see what I mean by 68 as a kind of transforming point. In any case, the French political philosopher Pierre Menant has suggested that the effectual, the animating philosophy of religion today, of Europe today, is a modernized form of Comte's religion of humanity. And I think that's right. For all intents and purposes, what I've called humanitarian democracy has become the common faith of post-1968 European democracy. If traditional religion made arduous demands on the moral conduct of human beings, if self-respecting political communities once depended on the willingness of free peoples to fight and need die for their country and the common good, the new humanitarianism makes few demands on its adherents. By the way, I should add parenthetically that it's quite true that after 1968, especially in France, under the impact of the publication of Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, many of the thinkers and actors, the younger people associated with the May events, turned on Soviet communism, rejected communist totalitarianism. But what did they turn to? They turned to a new religion of human rights. Okay? But as Aron famously said, human rights does not make a politics. Now, for this new humanitarian ethos, it's sufficient to reject ethnocentrism, to be wary of traditional morality, to show empathy for the weak and victimized wherever they may be found, except under Islamic and communist despotisms, and to aspire to a kind of nebulous global consciousness, and this from the fiercest critics of globalization. Deference to the moral authority of international organizations, no matter how ineffectual or illiberal, is also a requirement of the new humanitarianism. De Gaulle famously said in a speech in 1965, France would not defer her sovereignty to the UN, an organization dominated by communist and third world despotisms. One could not picture Dominique de Villepin saying the same thing 40 years later. All right, just want to say a word. My critique of your European humanitarian democracy is in no way intended as an exercise in American triumphalism. Pierre Menant, who I've drawn upon in a recently published book, La Raison des Nations, which came out in English translation from ISI Books, argues that in our own way, American conservative elites, especially neoconservative elites, have bought into a similar idea of democratic humanity. American neoconservatives recognize a connection between American power and the democratic project. But Americans are, and even conservative-minded Americans, are increasingly inclined to identify everything they do and everything we are with democracy as such. So self-proclaimed advocates of a world of democratic nations too readily dismiss the national self-assertion of other peoples, however moderate or humane, when that self-assertion challenges the American tendency to identify the national interest of the United States with the common good of humanity. By the way, instead of welcoming, for example, a certain healthy French desire to be a free and independent and self-assertive nation, it's better than being the opposite of those things. American conservatives tend to denounce that as evidence of delusions of grandeur or a Napoleonic syndrome. In other words, if patriotism and national self-assertion is good for us, it ought to be a certain form of moderate and self-critical patriotism is good for other peoples too. So in Menant's view, American theorists and politicians, especially of a conservative variant, too readily succumb to perhaps an identification of universalism with American nationalism and with certain illusions of our own about the end of history, global democratization, and the process, the easy prospects for creating a global middle-class society. So I think American conservatives in particular ought to be supporters, defenders, partisans of a stronger Europe. However, I would caution, I hesitate to identify that stronger, more politically minded, more confident or self-assertive Europe with the European project in its present form. I think a very good case could be made for the fact that the European project in its present form is increasingly imbued with this humanitarian spirit of which I've spoken. The other fundamental problem is Europeans have been obsessed with the indefinite territorial expansion of Europe at the expense of giving form and content to the European project. In other words, going from 6 to 12 to 18 to 25 to 27 is no substitute for reflection on the meaning, the self-definition of Europe. And again, I'm going to quote Manant, and I'll very close to ending my remarks. He writes, Europeans have placed their hopes in an idea of democracy that increasingly detaches democracy from all territory and any particular people. In a particularly striking formulation, he writes that, quote, the European version of democratic empire is marked by the radicality in which it detaches democracy from all real people and constructs a kratos without a demos. If we had more time, I could unpack the meaning of those words. But think of a kind of free-floating European a democracy, an imperium of rights, informed by indefinite territorial expansion, but increasingly unable to give rise to effective political action or self-assertion in the world. Hence the gap, one might say, between indefinite territorial expansion on the one hand and the fact that for all its admirable freedoms, all of its comparative economic well-being, Europe is not a serious player in international affairs the way an increasingly assertive Russia or China are, the way the United States is, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, and I'll just end in a very general note, I think what's really necessary on both sides of the Atlantic is a kind of a renewal of political and philosophical reflection on how to combine, to connect, to conjugate a capacity for resolute action on the one hand with moderation and prudent judgment on the other. And again, I've drawn on some European thinkers, primarily French thinkers. I too am a Francophile, who I think have begun that task. But I also think it's incumbent on American conservatives to begin thinking seriously and deeply about how a capacity for resolute action has to be accompanied